Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Barbara Mink. Mink is a professor of business communication at Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management. She's the former news director for WHCU, served on the Tompkins County Legislature for 12 years, five as the chair, and she's the founder and artistic director of the Light in Winter Festival. She's also an active painter. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I like having an underachiever on for a change. Listen, you have such an extensive biography of achievement, teaching, journalism, public service. You're an artist. Is there a common thread, do you think, that runs through these interests and endeavors in your life?
I'd say if there's any common thread, it would be teaching. I've always taught. I gave bar mitzvah lessons when I was a teenager. I was a teaching assistant as a PhD student at Cornell. I taught arts and crafts on an Indian reservation when I was a kid. And certainly as an adult, I always, the notion of teaching and translating, looking for subtexts, making hidden meanings clear, ran through my journalism, for sure, on WHCU. And I felt a very strong commitment to that kind of communication as a legislator. We started broadcasting the meetings then. We published a county newsletter. So I think if there were any thread, that would be it. Just explaining things.
Yeah. I would assume, I sort of assumed that you were going to say that. Now, you came to Ithaca from Buffalo in the 1970s, correct? But you first landed on the public radar when you became news director at WHCU. Is that correct
I
as well?
I guess so, sure.
How did you get into journalism?
I had come to Ithaca to get a PhD in comparative literature at Cornell, and I dropped out after a couple years. I knew it wasn't for me, and I had always done freelance ads for television and radio. So I was the voice of many banks and telephone companies. So I had an epiphany after I left Cornell. I went to Buffalo and did a commercial for Buffalo Savings Bank and Hanger's Department Store. And 8 hours standing with a Cuisinart in my arms, if you deposit $200, you too can get. I realized there's got to be more than this. So back in Ithaca, my then partner and current husband said that there was some radio station that played opera, so it's probably good. And this was WHCU, which at the time was owned by Cornell, HCU,
right.
FM, and AM.
Uh-huh.
So I went applying for advertising, but I went in the day the news director was on vacation, and two people had quit. So I was immediately hired for news, and 6 months later I was made news director. And it was just a wonderful time, 8 years of terrific bonding with the community in a very special way.
Oh, it's a great way to meet the community, as I know.
Yes,
and I
exactly.
sort of followed in your footsteps 20 years later.
Right.
You also taught journalism in the 1980s.
Yes.
Journalism has been tarnished greatly in the last few years. How do you think it's changed, and how would you be teaching it now, do you think? What would be the focus now?
Well, when I was teaching journalism, I first did a couple courses at Ithaca College and Cornell in the communications department just on the techniques of writing radio copy. But I started a course in journalistic ethics at Ithaca College, which didn't exist then.
And probably doesn't now.
Oh, no, I'm sure. No,
does it?
On the contrary, Tish.
Mm-hmm,
I think
mm-hmm.
Ithaca College has really grown the Roy H. Park School so that there are many more thoughtful and interesting courses now. I don't know firsthand, but I think that's true.
Uh-huh.
But at the time, it wasn't very, very talked about. And certainly now things have gotten more complicated. To me, in the late 70s and early 80s, they were the halcyon days for local radio broadcasting. At the time, WHCU had a staff of seven full-time reporters.
Mm-hmm.
WTKO was a competitive rival. They did the blood and guts. We did the more intellectual stuff. The Ithaca Journal was a very competitive newspaper, Ithaca Times, and everyone had a symbiotic relationship. And then with the advent of USA Today and the consolidation of a lot of news departments, things started plummeting. HCU was sold, of course. TKO went out of business. Everything got consolidated. And what happens is much less of a local focus and the kind of explaining history and interesting ideas that went on before. And as a result, you not only get very little or shabby journalism, you get a very angry electorate. And I certainly saw that when I went through the looking glass into politics. People, if they don't understand why things are happening and why their money is being spent in certain ways, why decisions are being made, there's a tremendous resentment that builds up.
Mm-hmm.
And that, along with the advent of talk radio, this phenomenon that swept the country, that I saw reflected as a politician when people would call me up, not give their names, rant, and then hang up, as opposed to enter into any kind of a discussion, which was a real first for me. And I think it's changed a lot of relationships, the one between journalists and newsmakers, one of those relationships.
Do you think this has to do with the lack of education in some ways in this country in regard to politics and history and brings us to where we are today?
That may be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that familiar with the curricula in the public schools. My daughter didn't go through it, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly sense a disaffection and a disinterest on the part of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I notice a lot of lack of cultural literacy, which is also part of it.
Cultural literacy.
Yeah, that's
sure.
Another aspect sure. of teaching, which is the root of,
right.
of what we're talking
right.
about in regard to your life. You did run for a seat on the Tompkins County Legislature in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was it public service that you wanted to get involved in, or were you interested in getting involved in the political game?
Oh, no, I had no interest in or illusions about the political game, having covered it for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know the limits of power on the local level, which is a very healthy thing, I think.
Uh-huh.
It's why I decided not to run for higher office after this. The phrase money corrupts is just never been truer.
It's an absolute, yeah.
So, but on the local level, you can really get a lot of things done. And I just like doing things. I like systems. I like organizations. I like effective, the kinds of words that make most people's eyes glaze over, but which really thrill me. You know, so we built buildings and we instituted new programs and worked as an effective board, as effective colleagues together.
Uh-huh.
So I found it a very satisfying experience. But
were you surprised by anything once you got into the arena after having just covered it for 8 years?
Yes, I was surprised at the inability to set your own agenda. I had the illusion that I was going to run on a platform. I did, and my pink campaign literature shows it from back then. Support for the arts, support for working women and for families. And for the first 5 years, it was garbage. That's all we were dealing with was garbage. I mean, it was
literally.
It was, literally. It was recycling. It was stopping a landfill. It was finding another way to deal with it. So, you know, most of government is crisis management. And you're lucky if you can start planning ahead and doing some kind of long-range thinking.
Uh-huh. So you had romantic notions about what you could actually do as a politician.
Semi-romantic,
in
yes.
some ways, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then by all accounts, you were extremely successful. What do you think some of the attributes you brought to the table in regard to this made you so successful?
Well, if that's true, I would say that probably an ability to listen and to actually mean it. I mean, I actually am interested in what people think and am always pleasantly surprised when someone has a better idea and then we can incorporate it. And I think people felt that, colleagues did, and that got a lot of things done.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt very strongly about communication. And I also don't like wasting time. So I must say, I ran a good meeting.
I used to sit in on some of those meetings. I can attest to that. So you think, do you think communication is, in fact, one of the attributes that one should wander into political office and possess?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I'm astounded, actually, if I do watch C-SPAN, and we were talking earlier about the current hearings, at how many people are completely inarticulate and almost willfully so, and that amazes me.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that someone who's in public office would want to communicate as clearly and as honestly as possible.
Mm-hmm. I have
and
always I,
there's a real
that
disconnect
too.
For me there.
There is with me too. And plus the people on a higher level, that they certainly have the power to affect the culture.
They have the power.
And it feels like we are turning into a little bit of an illiterate culture because of some of the people on the top in some.
If you're alluding to the anti-intellectual
national scene, yes,
I am. Or the feeling that smart people are bad and that reading is a waste, and I won't even go into all the details. Then probably so.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the TV broadcast that you started as a member of the Tompkins County Legislature. Well, why did you exactly want to do that? I've heard people say that politicians act better in front of a camera and they're not really themselves. And then you're not really seeing the real people.
That was certainly a worry when you started. I never saw that to be the case. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of grandstanding and a certain from certain people, but not everyone. Most of the time, people just forget it's there. And I thought it was important for viewers to be able to follow a line of argument because you'll never get it in the reports afterwards. It's impossible. You can't have reports in the daily newspapers that would give a good account of hours of meeting time. Mm-hmm. Very few people watch hour to hour, but when there's a certain issue, people tune in. And they see not only what their elected representatives say, but how they say it and how they react to other people. It's very revealing.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you get to know a person in some ways. You know, I mean, some
of
them are.
You get to feel that you know them.
Yeah, I mean, some people are acting and preening in front of the camera and so on. I saw that a lot in San Francisco, actually.
Wow.
You know, one thing in your biography that I'm very, very interested in and curious about, as you know, is the fact that you began painting quite late in life. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you took that step, and you've been so devoted to it. Mm-hmm. You even studied.
My father's a painter, and I was interested as a child, but seeded that ground early. So I was always, an actor for a while, and certainly more in the humanities. And I never took art classes or did anything since I was about 10 or 11. But for a couple years, I was making fancy little girls' clothes. For a couple of years, I was painting glassware, doing kind of crafty things. So there was obviously something tactile that wanted to come out.
Uh-huh.
And then one morning, in January in 1999, I woke up and wanted to paint. And I got my daughter's watercolors and ruined a whole thing of paper. Then I went to New York to an artist friend for a day, and she sat me down with a red pepper and a rose. And then I took a class from the late Benta King in botanical illustration and did watercolor flowers for a few years. The problem with the class was everyone was really wonderful, and they did these beautifully life-sized, meticulous flower drawings, but mine were always huge. And I think it's in part because I'm nearsighted, but I also like the scale. So I blossomed out from there and started doing oils a few years ago and haven't stopped doing that.
Uh-huh. Who are you influenced by? Who are some of your favorite painters that you might or might not be influenced by, but
well,
certainly...
I never felt influenced, but certainly attracted to different painters along the way, depending on what I was doing. I mean, there were Chardin still lifes for a while, which I loved. There was Monet, of course.
Oh, yes.
Matisse for the color. Joan Snyder for the freedom. Rauschenberg for the whimsy. So I really don't know, but... Right now I'm doing very large-scale abstract landscapes, which were in part inspired by the aerial views of New Orleans after Katrina. For some reason that resonated. And so I'm looking for people who do things like that, and I find people like Rauschenberg and Snyder. And so it's kind of a back-and-forth process.
Uh-huh.
I look, and then I find.
I've noticed, but... When I first started viewing your work, it was flowers and watercolors and very pretty things. Mm-hmm. Your stuff has gotten immensely darker.
Mm.
Do you have any reasoning behind that,
or
is it just a color
palette.
Process?
I like the palette. Yeah, I like blue, green, and a little red. seriously, I really don't hold for me with any kind of psychological input. I don't feel it. I don't think it's there. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear people analyze paintings and different things come out that I'm not aware of. But as far as I'm concerned, that's a process. The viewer can see what she wants. But
Are you surprised by how successful you've been? You've sold dozens of paintings, and you've had quite a few exhibits.
Very grateful. It's very validating.
And I know artists who've been working for 20 years who've maybe sold two or three pieces. So I think it does attest to the fact that you have quite a talent. You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Barbara Mink. I want to talk to you about Light and Winter. Now, this is a fascinating new segue in your life. You're the founder and artistic director of the festival. Where did you come up with the idea to fuse music, art, and science? Mm. It's a fascinating idea.
Well, it's proven to really have legs in a way that I never thought at the time. In a way, it's kind of along the continuum of what you were talking about in the beginning of explaining and exploring and finding subtext and so on. And it's also a continuation politically for me, because I feel it's important that people have a chance to think about things that they may not think they have a right to because they don't have the training or the background. And that's what I found in these last few years, that artsy people are thrilled at getting some grasp of some aspect of math or science. And the same is true with the mathematicians and scientists, who are often much more comfortable with art but enjoy looking at things through these different prisms. Mm-hmm. It started in, must have been 2000, I guess. There are a couple origin myths. One is that I just got tired of driving my musician daughter across the country to various music camps, so I thought we should have something here in the summer. It started as an idea for a summer, an East Coast Aspen, a kind of a summer music and arts festival. But a couple things changed that. One was that Tompkins County was very interested in promoting winter tourism and urged us to move it to the winter, which I resisted mightily.
I can understand why.
Well, yes, mm-hmm. I mean, it's always a risk. But it's turned out to be a very good idea, because it's right on the cusp of the beginning of the semester. It's after all the holidays are done. And as long as the weather is not terrible, it's fun to go inside and do this sort of activity, this sort of thinking and experiential thing, as opposed to competing with a beautiful sunshiny day or the water and things like that. Uh-huh. So in that sense, it's worked. One of our board members, Dick Riley, had suggested the notion of incorporating science in some way, because science was becoming so popular. And that's what makes it unique, it turns out. There's no other festival in the United States like this. There are conferences, and there are self-selected groups who look at technology and art or math and music and things like that. But there's not a general festival that aims at an audience that is intellectually curious.
Yeah, and it's also
trained.
For lay people, too. I mean, it's not so complicated that it's,
lay people.
That it's beyond people like some conferences would be.
Exactly, not at all. No, it's meant to be fun as well as stimulating. I work very hard to make sure it's not dumbed down in any way,
but that it's
still accessible. Because I'm the perfect guinea pig. I'm a mathophobe, and I'm now reading every math and science book I can read, and by God, I still don't get it. But there's
that has
hope.
Happened to me
but
as well.
Hope.
Well, the fact that you're still trying,
challenge.
I have given up on math,
no,
but I am totally
up.
Fascinated by science.
Yes, I know. There
Absolutely.
Is a difference. There is a difference.
And I've always thought about the correlation between math and music.
Oh, yeah. That's
because
that's
of some of the people
in.
I have known. Yeah.
Sure.
Do you find the same challenges as the artistic director of Light and Winter as you did as chair of the board?
The same
kinds of challenges in regard to leadership,
oh,
I suppose
gosh.
I'm aiming at?
No, I'd say it's different in the sense that I get to run things more. On the board, I could set a tone and then needed to work much more in terms of persuasion and delegation for other people. And so far, this has been mainly a very small group of people who are actually carrying out things. And I love it, being able to come up with the ideas and put it together and find the performers and all the logistics. And it's a year-round process, and luckily I have wonderful co-workers and a wonderful board. That's the only way we could do this. It seems strange. It's just a three-day festival, and yet it's a very highly produced professional thing. So it takes a whole year.
I'm sure
to,
it does take on. Yeah, I've noticed how it takes all year round for you.
Yes.
I want to play a little piece from Simone Shaheen, one of the people who's going to perform.
He's our opening nighter, yes.
About his work and what he's going to do.
He's a master of the oud, which is a Middle Eastern lute, and also a wonderful violinist. He was born in Palestine and is now based in New York. And he gives classes and concerts all over the world. And we've been talking for over a couple years about doing a tour, a musical tour of the Levant, which is another way of talking about that part of the world. And he's bringing members of his Near Eastern Music Ensemble, which is more traditional Middle Eastern music, and members of his jazz fusion group, Kantara. So there'll be a wonderful crossover there in musical styles. But I'm hoping that Simon will give a lecture during the concert Friday night. He's giving a workshop Saturday morning for musicians and non-musicians who want to get more involved in the intricacies of what makes Middle Eastern music sound so strange to us. The beat, the counting, the timbre, the half notes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different system, but it's awfully interesting and just wonderful music.
Uh-huh. And as you know, I spoke with Laurie Anderson a couple of
yes,
weeks ago.
Yes, it was lovely.
That was quite a feat to get her, especially as she's coming as artist in residence for NASA. Well, what an interesting fusion that was.
Well, she's the epitome of fusion.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, she's this one person who combines everything that we've been talking about.
Uh-huh.
We're very fortunate. She's extended her tour. This is her last North American performance of End of the Moon for Light and Winter. So
very
grateful.
Heard that. Yeah. How do you decide who you're going to have on? Do you have people asking to come on? How do you decide?
Oh, yes.
Are there people who might be a bit too complicated for a lay audience who
haven't asked
to come on?
I seek. I read all the time. I read magazines and newspapers and books.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read something wonderful, I call up that person. And sometimes I put him or her together with someone, sometimes not. Mario Olivio, who's doing The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, is an example. I read his book last year, The Golden Ratio, and I thought it was so wonderful. I called him up and asked him to come, and he said, well, I'm writing another book. I said, great. So he's going to talk about that book, which is about group theory in math and symmetry in math and nature and philosophy. So that's just fascinating. And then other things, I put together people who would work well together to explore an idea. The finale this year is a good example, Forces of Nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we're looking at essentially seismic activity, earthquakes, tsunamis, and the seismic conditions in New Orleans that created all the havoc. And Charlie Troutman from the Science Center, who's also a geologist, is our scientist. And in the between the sections is going to be a marvelous film created by Insights International with live music scoring by Judy Hyman and Jeff Kloss from the Horseflies and three guests. And that's only the first half. And then the second half will continue looking at preventing the damage of forces of nature with Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which, contrary to those of us who grew up with Fantasia, Rite of Spring wasn't about the birth of the world. It was really about sacrificing virgins to assuage the gods to prevent this damage. But we won't be doing that on stage.
Are they going to do that at one of the local theaters?
We will have the Lumpa doing choreography to the live piano performance.
Oh, fascinating.
And that ends the finale. So that's the kind of example of putting things together.
Uh-huh. Well, what else can we expect from Barbara Mink besides Light and Winter in regard to art and what you might be doing next? You have any you have exhibits?
Speechless. I can't imagine doing anything else. But thank you for asking. I do have a couple exhibits coming up. And I'm happy that I'm going to be exhibiting in Hudson, New York in next fall in the Carrie Haddad Gallery. So that'll be edging closer to the big city. So that's exciting.
That's exactly right, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so Light and Winter, do you already have things planned for next year?
Yes.
Are you already involved in that?
Yeah, it's pretty well set.
We cannot stop you. Do you think you'll ever run for office again?
Oof.
Ever get back into the political arena? Do you miss it?
I miss it sometimes. I went to a farewell party for a former colleague the other night, and it walked in and it felt like an urban family, recognized everyone and felt very much at home. I miss that.
Uh-huh.
And I think anybody who's been in that kind of group does. I yell at the TV. I long to go through that screen and get up and really ask a question.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Demand an answer. But I don't think so at this point. I think it's too big for me and too nebulous and possibly too compromised. So I think at this stage in my life, I would like to work on a smaller level and change a few minds a few at a time.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a fabulous goal, actually. I want to ask you another question about art. How do you think art touches people? Do you think it touches people in the same way that politics does? Can it change minds and change people's lives?
I think art can change people's lives. and possibly change people's minds. I'm thinking of Guernica, of course, and the kinds of pieces that emerge from a particular time and place. I think a lot of protest art or art that's tied too specifically to an event falls flat for me because it seems so obvious and calculated. But I remember, in fact, I think I told you in one of our conversations, when I was in London at one time, I saw a Turner exhibition, and I just broke down crying uncontrollably, and I don't know why. Part of it was just overwhelmed, and I think about it now, by the extreme beauty of these pieces, by their unattainability by someone who was working in that mode at the time, being there in that time and place. And, you know, maybe that's an extreme reaction, but I do think that the visual arts, music, play an extremely important part in people's lives because it keeps the mind fresh if you're open to things.
Absolutely, yeah.
I find it very sad when people are afraid to make judgments about things or to listen three times to a new piece because it's too different from what they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were referring to this before in terms of the cultural literacy. Cultural literacy, in part, is based on people's willingness to learn. And for me, that's what Light and Winter is about. I mean, that's why I do keep doing that, and that's why I don't see it as taking away from other important things that I'm doing. I find it at the center of what I'm interested in, which is constantly exploring new ideas, making new connections, and growing as a person. I think if we don't do that, I can't imagine why we're here.
Wanting to stay alive, yeah.
Yeah.
How has art changed since you became somebody who does art instead of just witnesses it?
Well, I don't know if art has changed, but certainly, you know, it's like the reports of abuse. Is there more abuse or is it just noticing more?
Mm-hmm. I guess I could say, how has art changed you now that you are making it?
Well, it certainly changes the way I go through a museum. I don't like to go with people because I don't like...
Really?
Well, I don't like standing in front of something and talking and looking. I'm looking for specific techniques that I can use. So it's a slanted and, you know, it's not for the joy as much as the borrowing. But I still do like... I do like going to contemporary galleries a lot, almost more than museums sometimes. But I do know that it seems that the spate of installation art, video art, conceptual art, which has been talked about since the 60s pretty much, is really dominant. I went to a biennale in Lyon when I was teaching in Paris last month, and the whole thing was conceptual video, no painting, no two-dimensional representation of any kind. And if I'm going to be true to what I just said before, I have to have an open mind and understand what is being meant there. But at this point, I don't get it. So I think there's more learning that has to go on.
How can somebody get in touch with you if they want to get involved in the festival or see your art or?
Oh, well, I'm on the Light and Winter website. It's lightandwinter.com. And I'm also on my website, which is barbaramink.com.
Barbara Mink, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tish. It's a pleasure.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.